Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, solo today. Today we're going to talk about a pretty polarizing legal topic, but we're going to come at it as a rational discussion topic and not just based on the emotional response that it frequently generates. Today's topic was suggested by friend of the show, Eric Williams. So thank you, Eric. Eric proposed to dive into the death penalty. So buckle up, because in this episode, we're going to be talking school shooters, sentencing aggravators, mitigation, judicial discretion, and of course, the decision on whether or not to impose the death penalty. I think it's very important to note from the outset that I have my own opinions on the death penalty, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'll be upfront about my opposition to it. We'll get into my personal philosophy on the ultimate punishment towards the conclusion of the episode, but I wanted you all to be aware of how I feel, because I want you to make your own decisions. And if you perceive that my stance is biased, I want to be upfront about that so that you can choose to go your own way if you want. Now, recently, there was a case which took headlines by storm. It's been covered extensively all over the country. I've been invited onto the Law and Crime Network several times over the last few months to talk about it. On February 14th, 2018, Valentine's Day, was a Wednesday. On that particular day, a 19-year-old boy took an Uber to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, located in Parkland, Florida. Parkland is located about 45 miles northwest of Miami. The boy was dressed in a maroon t-shirt with the school logo on it, because he thought it might help him blend in. He carried a fabric duffel bag with him, as well as a backpack. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, or MSD as students call it, is a collection of connected buildings, and this particular individual decided to walk into Building 12. Building 12 is three stories, 10 classrooms per floor, and during the school day, when this person was there, you would expect there to be about 900 students and around 30 teachers in that particular area of the school. In the hallway of Building 12, the boy opened the duffel bag and drew an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. He then began to fire indiscriminately down the hallway at students and teachers. When the gunshots started, there was confusion. Nobody knew what the loud bangs were. But that quickly turned to chaos, terror, and panic as bodies started to fall. The boy walked down the hallway, peering into classrooms, executing those who had just been injured from previous shots. The fire alarm went off. The school went into lockdown. The police were called. Starting on the first floor, he walked the length of the hallway and went upstairs to both the second and third floors. 14 students and three teachers, 17 people in total, were dead by the time the shooting stopped. The shooter discarded the duffel bag, the rifle, and his backpack, and ultimately ran outside, attempting to camouflage in with the hordes of teens fleeing the carnage. All of the death, the countless lifetimes of surviving grief, and the horror took place in a total of less than 4 minutes. After he left the school, he walked down the street till he got to a McDonald's, where another MSD student was eating. The student had no idea whatsoever what had just taken place at his high school. The shooter tried to get the boy to give him a ride, but the boy declined. He would later find out his sister had been killed in Building 12. With no ride, the boy kept walking until he was identified by an astute police officer, roughly 2 miles from MSD. Police and SWAT had reviewed the surveillance footage at the school, and eyewitnesses had identified the boy. Police were blasted with his photo. He was found less than 2 hours after the shooting, arrested and charged with the worst school shooting in the history of the United States up until that time. This is The state of Florida versus Nicholas Cruz. There are certain historical events that you remember the precise moment you learned about them. I was in Mr. Miller's high school AP economics class when we abruptly stopped a lecture, turned on the TV, and watched a plane hit the World Trade Center. I cut Ursula Bentley's criminal law class at Brooklyn Law School to take a bus to Philly and be at the Fox and Hound Bar on 15th Street on October 29th, 2008, when the Phillies won the World Series over the Rays. And I remember being with a group of friends on the evening of April 20th, 1999, learning that a trench coat clad student had opened fire in Columbine High School in Colorado. Since Columbine, this country has been devastated over and over again by the news of more and more school shootings. Students in institutions designed to prepare them for the life ahead of them, having those lives cut short in acts of senseless violence. Columbine was far from the first time a student or former student had opened fire in a school, but it was the first in a series over the last 23 years or so, which has become increasingly troubling. And we've also had Red Lake, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Santa Monica, Santa Fe, Uvalde, and Parkland, just to name a few. Mass shootings are always horrifically unsettling events. They frequently leave us as a society with more answers than questions. I've said this on the show in previous episodes. We human beings tend to fear things that we don't understand. And the infliction of mass death on strangers just defies logic. We don't struggle at all to comprehend how a drug deal gone bad can leave a body count, or how an abused spouse can snap and kill the abuser. We intrinsically understand anger, jealousy, greed, and even hate. But mass shootings seem to stem from a combination of disaffection, antisocial behavior, loneliness, narcissism, and a deep desire to be seen, heard, and remembered. As horrible as mass shootings are, when it takes place in a school, there is another level of revulsion involved. Children are vulnerable and innocent. The darkness of the world hasn't yet beaten them down or jaded them, so it's especially difficult to hear that groups of students or teachers gathered to learn have had their sparks extinguished. Today we're going to talk about Parkland, and specifically about the prosecution of Nicholas Cruz. Now, typically, I like to provide a bit of background about the subject of the episode before getting really into the meat of the litigation. I think that understanding a little bit about how somebody grew up can provide some insight into the how and why certain actions were made or decisions were taken. I'm not going to do that in this episode, largely because Nicholas Cruz's background became a huge part of the case itself. And I think for the purposes of understanding the arguments of the prosecutor and the defense team, you should get them with some continuity. So, all in good time. We go now to what we know about the incident itself. Cruz was 19 years old. He had previously attended MSD, though he was expelled in 2017. We know from witness testimony that he was observed getting out of an Uber in the afternoon of February 14th, 2018, right in front of MSD. He was recognized by a school employee who saw him wearing a maroon MSD shirt with black pants and a black hat, carrying a black duffel bag, wearing a black backpack. Cruz didn't speak to anybody, and he was clearly not enrolled in MSD at the time. He just walked straight to Building 12. But the employee didn't notify security, he didn't call in a code red, he didn't follow Cruz. Instead, Cruz was able to walk unimpeded right into Building 12 at around 2:20 p.m. during the school day. And unless you've been living under a rock for the last 4.5 years or so, you already know what happened next. Cruz walked into the first floor hallway, opened his duffel bag, revealing his AR-15 rifle. And within seconds, he was shooting at students or teachers unlucky enough to be in the hallway. He fired into classrooms, through windows. He had no specific targets. He just fired at anything that was moving. Cruz brought several extra magazines. He reloaded several times as he moved from the first floor to the second, and then to the third. While on the third floor, he looked out a window and saw students fleeing. He attempted to shoot out the window to open fire on the crowd as they ran away, but he was unable to break it. And then 4 minutes after the shooting started, it was over. Cruz's rifle jammed, so he dropped it, shed the backpack, and exited Building 12, catching up to crowds running away from the school in a panic. He engaged with a few students who were confused as to what was going on, and ultimately just walked away. He really didn't seem to have much of an exit plan. He wandered down a street until he stopped in at a Subway restaurant and got a drink, then went to a nearby McDonald's where he ran into MSD freshman John Wilford. Wilford didn't know that anything had happened at MSD that day, and he certainly didn't know that his sister, Maddie Wilford, would be counted among the 14 dead students. Cruz sat down next to Wilford in the McDonald's, in a scene caught on surveillance video. He tried to get Wilford to give him a ride. Wilford politely declined and left, as his mother was in the parking lot to pick him up. Cruz then left the McDonald's and continued walking down the road. In the meantime, police and SWAT teams had swarmed MSD. They'd reviewed surveillance tapes and spoken to some eyewitnesses. They'd been informed that the shooter's name was Nicholas Cruz. His photo was sent out to all law enforcement in the area. And at around 3:40 p.m., an astute patrolman spotted Cruz on the side of the road around 2 miles away from the school. He got out of his car, he called for backup, and Cruz was arrested. As we noted earlier, by 2018, America had gone through Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, and others. It really pains me to say it, but at this point, we were no stranger to school shootings. There was never any doubt in this case as to whether Nicholas Cruz was the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooter. He never denied it. He never claimed the cops got the wrong guy, that he was somewhere else, that he was being set up. Instead, in his police interrogations after his arrest, he talked about voices, demons, telling him what to do. He said he'd been hearing voices for years, commanding him to kill and destroy, but that he'd never spoken about them to anybody before. And as with every major criminal case which gets national attention, there are ebbs and flows of coverage. At the time of the incident and the arrest, it's the only story on any news station, and for good reason. The days after, it'll still be pretty ubiquitous. Different news outlets will come up with new angles and different tangents to pursue. You'll get stories about a defendant's parents, or their childhood best friend, or the time they killed a squirrel in third grade, or that they bit the dentist while getting a cavity filled. There's a lot of sensationalism, and savvy consumers of media won't be so quick to believe everything in every story. But the news cycle will eventually keep going, and at some point, even school shooters fall out of headlines. Until something happens in court. If there's a court appearance where anything substantive is discussed, there will be reporters there. Usually it'll be a smaller, maybe shorter story, and it may not get a lot of press unless it has some gripping new information. And that's what happened in the Cruz case. I'm sure it will not shock listeners to hear that while Nicholas Cruz was pending trial, he was remanded. For those of you who don't work in or interact with the criminal law industry, that means he was held in jail without bail. Cruz spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. He was considered extremely dangerous. He was also considered a potential target for other inmates. Perhaps in a later episode, we'll get into the code among inmates and the hierarchy of how what lands a person in jail will affect how other inmates treat them. For today, just know that a 19 or 20-year-old school shooter is not going to be treated terribly well by other inmates. But even people in solitary confinement are given time for recreation, to stretch their legs. Trust me, it's not much, and there are little to no resources for people to avail themselves of. But on November 13th, 2018, Cruz was in an emptied-out common room, walking laps, under the supervision of Sergeant Ray Beltran. The room was empty, except for those two. There were a few bolted-down tables and chairs, but other than that, the room was bare. As Cruz was walking in his slow circles with his head down, surveillance video from the jail shows that he slowed down further and began dragging his feet near Beltran. Beltran would later testify that he told Cruz to stop shuffling his feet or that his slippers would fall off. Cruz stopped, turned, stuck up both his middle fingers, and then charged Beltran, tackling him to the ground and wrestling to get Beltran's taser out of its holder. The taser went off, but missed both of them. Beltran was able to stagger Cruz by punching him in the face. He then cuffed him and returned him to his cell. While his murder trial was still pending, Cruz pleaded guilty to assaulting Beltran in the jail. Now, this will come up later, so just keep it in mind that while one case was pending, Cruz had an incident and pled guilty to it in the jail. And naturally, this incident set newspapers and news anchors into a frenzy. Cruz was back in primetime media. He would surface in the media again here and there as his defense team filed motions and briefs, but largely his case didn't get a whole lot of coverage again for quite some time. But then on October 20th, 2021, that changed again. Nicholas Cruz pleaded guilty to all 17 counts of murder. It's important to take a moment to fully address Cruz's decision here. Now, I was not on Nicholas Cruz's defense team, and having watched them operate, I can say that they were more than competent. But that being said, I don't understand this decision at all. Florida is a death penalty state. Between 1976 and 2021, only three states, Texas, Virginia, and Oklahoma, have executed more people than the state of Florida. Florida has executed more people than Alabama, than Louisiana, than Mississippi, than Georgia, than Tennessee. So while executions aren't exactly a frequent occurrence, they very much do happen in Florida. And typically, when an individual is charged with a capital crime, meaning a crime which could potentially carry a death sentence, it's not uncommon for a defense attorney to broker a deal for the defendant to plead guilty in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table. The person would accept a life sentence, but would not be under the threat of execution. Sometimes that's really the only bargaining chip that a lawyer has. Prosecutors will often accept this deal to spare the victims or their families from having to testify at a gut-wrenching trial. The offender will then fade into the abyss of a maximum security prison until a Netflix documentary is made about them or a podcast comes out reviewing the investigation. Back in the 2018 to 2021 time period, that's kind of how I expected the Nicholas Cruz case to end. There's no question he was the shooter. He was never going to convince a jury that he wasn't. The only conceivable chance that he had was to argue insanity. And that's an incredibly difficult argument to win. We'll talk more about this later as well. But I thought Cruz was going to accept life in prison, with no possibility of execution and no possibility of parole, in exchange for a guilty plea to the 17 murders. But I was wrong. And this has baffled me since October of 2021 when it happened. I still don't get it. Cruz pleaded guilty to all 17 murders and got nothing. He waived a trial, but he didn't get the death penalty taken off the table. Effectively, what this meant was that instead of a trial to determine his guilt, innocence, or lack of responsibility through mental disease, he would go straight to a hearing to determine whether he would get the death penalty. So if Cruz wanted to avoid the death penalty, that failed. If prosecutors wanted to spare the victims' families the pain of testifying, that failed. If Cruz wanted the notoriety of a huge public trial on his mental illness, that failed. Essentially, Cruz just relieved the prosecutors of the burden of proving his guilt and gave them the ability to proceed right to a hearing on the sentence. As the whole thing unfolded, I kept thinking that at some point, the strategy behind this would be revealed, that the defense team, which was basically half of the Broward County Public Defender's Office, had a plan in mind that this fed into. But nothing ever materialized for me. I still don't understand the thought process behind this. And ultimately, the decision to plead guilty or go to trial is one of the few decisions that a client has an absolute right to make. So if Cruz decided he wanted to just plead guilty, then so be it. But I don't really think that comports with what we know about his personality. Procedurally, let's take a moment and discuss the mechanics of the plea. When a criminal defendant agrees to forego a trial and plead guilty, there's a whole process which takes place, with very slight variation between the various states and the federal system. It's pretty uniform. The plea has to be taken on what's called the record. That means it has to be done in court while the case is technically in the process of being heard by the judge. There needs to be some sort of record taken. Usually that's done with a court reporter. But some jurisdictions have set up a recording device to capture everything that happens and will only transcribe it if somebody needs a copy. But either way, there has to be an exact record of what happened, and we call that the record of the case. We say the record holds. It is the standard for what happened. If during a trial you're absolutely 110% metaphysically certain that John Smith testified that he witnessed a shooting take place on Monday, but you ask to review that testimony and the official record taken by the court reporter shows that John Smith testified that he witnessed a shooting take place on a Tuesday, then it does not matter how certain you are about what you remember. The testimony was that the shooting was on a Tuesday, because that is what the record says. All substantive proceedings in a case must take place on the record. There can be minor conversations between the parties and a judge off the record, but things like hearings, trials, decisions and orders, pleas, and sentences must take place on the record. Pleading guilty doesn't just mean that the defendant shows up in court, says, "I want to plead guilty," everyone goes their separate ways. In the American criminal justice system, in order to actually plead guilty, the judge and the prosecutor must be satisfied that the defendant is actually guilty. Now, this is usually not a difficult burden for the prosecutor. If they're bringing the case, they believe the person is guilty. But the judge is intended, at least, to be a neutral arbiter who theoretically believes that a defendant is innocent until proven guilty. This means that the defendant will have to offer what's called an allocution. That means that during the plea, the defendant will be put under oath, meaning they'll have to swear to tell the truth under penalties of perjury, and then they will have to tell the judge what they did in order for them to be guilty. They have to confess to the specific crimes for which they are pleading. Some of my more seasoned or experienced lawyer listeners are definitely going to send me emails, "Paul, what about offered pleas? They don't require a defendant to admit to any specific criminal acts." Okay, technically, that is true. There was a case back in 1970 called North Carolina v. Alford, A-L-F-O-R-D, and it established a doctrine that it is legally permissible for a defendant to plead guilty while protesting innocence. The fact is that Alford pleas are incredibly rare. Prosecutors almost never agree to it, and some judges won't even accept them because of the headache they can cause on appeal. Legally permissible, in practice, almost never happens. Generally speaking, a guilty plea requires a confession to the acts constituting the crime. In addition to the allocution, the judge informs the defendant of the rights that he or she is giving up in order to plead guilty, and establishes that they are pleading guilty voluntarily and with the full knowledge of the consequences of their plea. The judge will ask questions like whether or not the defendant is intoxicated or on any medication which impairs thought or cognition. They'll ask if the defendant has had sufficient time to talk the plea offer over with their lawyer, and whether the lawyer has explained all the trial rights that the defendant is giving up. Judges take special care to ensure that all grounds are covered on pleas, specifically to make it very difficult for a person later to try and withdraw that plea. By the time a person has pleaded guilty, they have sworn under oath that they committed the acts which constituted the crime, that nobody pressured them or promised them something improper to plead guilty, that they are of sound mind, that they understand English, that they're satisfied with their lawyer, that the representation was good, and that they understand that a guilty plea will come with some form of punishment. Now, vacating a guilty plea is not impossible, but it is a difficult burden to overcome. One thing that a defendant waives by pleading guilty is the ability to argue that he should not be held criminally responsible for his actions because of a mental disease or defect. In effect, Cruz gave up his right to argue to a jury that he shouldn't be held criminally liable because he's insane. The issue of liability is closed when a defendant pleads guilty. While I don't think there was much chance that Cruz could possibly have prevailed at trial using an insanity defense, choosing to not even try makes no sense to me. You don't lose anything at that point by making the argument, and in fact, you lay the foundation for the arguments which his team did, in fact, insert during his sentencing hearing. And the reason I don't think Cruz, who is clearly deeply mentally ill, would have prevailed using an insanity defense at trial is very simple. There is a significant difference between being mentally ill and being found not criminally responsible for one's actions because of mental illness. In the United States, we convict mentally ill people of crimes every single day. The standard to win using the insanity defense, which the defense has to establish, is incredibly difficult. This is true in Florida, New York, the federal system. It's pretty tough just about everywhere you can try it. Florida follows what's called the Minotin rule, which is similar to what New York uses. The defense has to establish by clear and convincing evidence, which is a level of certainty between a preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant was suffering from mental illness at the time of his actions, and that due to the mental illness, he either did not know what he was doing or he did not know that it was wrong. In this case, there is ample evidence which very clearly showed that Nicholas Cruz knew what he was doing, that it was premeditated. And we're going to get into that when we discuss the punishment hearing momentarily. But even if arguing the insanity defense was an incredibly low percentage chance for victory, in my opinion, it would have been better to try. Maybe you could convince one juror to hold out, get a hung jury, cause a mistrial, who knows? Again, Cruz doesn't do that. He doesn't go to trial. Cruz appears in front of the Honorable Judge Elizabeth Scherer and pleads guilty. She was appointed by then-Governor Rick Scott on December 14, 2012, and was re-elected judge without opposition in 2014 and again in 2020. Judge Scherer finds Cruz mentally competent enough to plead guilty and notes that the prosecutors have still indicated that they intend to seek the death penalty. Let's talk about the death penalty in Florida. Since 1976, the state of Florida has executed 99 people. There are currently 330 people on death row in Florida waiting to be executed, including three women. Florida permits individuals to choose whether they want lethal injection or electrocution. There's a lot of confusion, and in watching the Nicholas Cruz trial myself, I saw a lot of people speaking authoritatively on the death penalty in Florida who had absolutely no idea how one finds themselves on death row. So let me clear this up for you. In Florida, murder can be punishable by execution if one of 16 possible aggravating factors is found. Here are a couple examples which listeners may find applicable to a school shooting case. Factor number 3, the defendant knowingly created a great risk of death to many persons. Factor number 8, it was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. Number 9, it was committed in a cold, calculated, and premeditated manner without any pretense of moral or legal justification. Long before the trial, within 45 days of the arraignment, actually, the prosecutor has to inform the defendant and the judge by way of an officially filed notice that it plans to seek the death penalty should the defendant be convicted. Under Florida criminal procedure law, if a defendant is convicted of murder and the prosecutor has filed that notice of intention to seek the death penalty, then the law says the court shall conduct a separate sentencing proceeding to determine whether the defendant should be sentenced to death or life in prison. That's section 921.141 of the Florida criminal procedure law, for those itching to Google it. So after the trial, there's an additional hearing. Ideally, under the law, it's in front of the same jury that heard the trial. They're already familiar with the case. Saves a lot of time and effort to reintroduce all the evidence. But there are provisions in the event that this is not feasible, and a separate jury can be impaneled. In that hearing, the prosecutor will present evidence that at least one of those 16 aggravating factors we mentioned previously were present. Now let's take a moment and discuss jury selection. It's a little bit different than the standard jury selection process, which we've covered in other episodes when we're talking about death penalty cases. Jurors in capital punishment cases have to be what is called death qualified. That means that the judge has to explicitly question them about whether they would, if they found that the prosecutor had established one of those necessary aggravating factors, return a verdict of death. If a juror were to say, "Look, I can be fair and imbalanced, but I'm opposed to the death penalty. Even if I find the prosecutor proved all 16 factors to my satisfaction, I just will not vote for death," the judge is going to say, "Thank you very much. This trial is not for you," and excuse them. Even if they would be fair and impartial on the issue of liability, if there is an issue with the imposition of the death penalty, the juror will be excused. All 12 jurors, and usually 2 to 3 alternates, will have to affirmatively state that they will render a sentencing recommendation of death if appropriate. The sentencing hearing is similar in many ways to the trial itself, but instead of trying to prove guilt by establishing every element of a charged crime beyond a reasonable doubt, the prosecutor is trying to establish one or more of those 16 aggravating factors. The defense attorney, on the other hand, seeks to sway the jury by establishing that one or more of 8 specifically enumerated mitigating factors exist. There are 8 listed in the statute, but they're much more vague than the aggravating factors, so it doesn't make sense to think of it as just 8 particular narrow avenues of argument for a defense attorney. These are things like the defendant has no criminal history, the defendant was under duress at the time, the defendant was an accomplice rather than a principal actor, and the last one, factor number 8, reads as follows. The existence of any other factors in the defendant's background that would mitigate against imposition of the death penalty. So literally, 8 factors are listed in the statute, but factor number 8 is, and anything else you can think of. Here are the potential ways that the death penalty can play out. If the sentencing jury decides unanimously to sentence the defendant to life, then the sentence is life. The judge cannot overrule the jury and impose the death penalty. If there is a division, anywhere from 6-6 to 11-1, then the sentence must be life. If even one juror votes for life as opposed to the death penalty, then the defendant will be sentenced to life and the judge cannot overrule it. If the jury hands down a unanimous vote for the death penalty, then the judge is permitted to impose the death penalty. But permitted does not mean required. The judge has the option then to either sentence execution or life imprisonment. I could not find the exact numbers, but apparently judges very frequently follow the recommendation of the jury if they vote to impose the death sentence. It's not 100% universal, but judges, it seems, typically go with it. As I said at the outset, I'm not in favor of the death penalty. But I do think that this is a far better system than simply having a judge make the decision after a jury convicts or a defendant pleads guilty. The death penalty seems to me far less likely to be imposed when you have to get 12 people from the community to look a defendant in the eye and recommend that he, or she, three women on death row, remember, is to be executed. I'm also in favor of giving the judge the ability to buck the jury and impose life at the end of the day if the judge feels that that would be appropriate. There is a bit of checks and balances applied, which I'd still be in favor of abolishing it completely, but this is a better system than a sole arbiter. I'm going to buck trends here and give away the ending, although if you follow the show at all, it means you're probably at least moderately interested in the headlines which cover these types of cases, so most of you probably at this point already know where this ended up. Nicholas Cruz was given a sentence of life imprisonment by the jury, meaning Judge Schur cannot overrule it and is bound to make that her sentence. Cruz cannot get the death penalty. I have a few friends who support the death penalty, and I've had some very interesting discussions with them once this sentence came down. They knew I would be in favor since I oppose the death penalty, and I knew that they would disagree with the decision because, quite frankly, if someone who guns down 14 students and three teachers doing a school day for no reason whatsoever doesn't deserve the death penalty, it's kind of hard to imagine who would, right? Both my pro-death penalty friends and pretty much every parent of a student at Parkland who participated in the press conference after the event of the sentencing verdict echoed that message. If Nicholas Cruz doesn't deserve the death penalty, who really does? The jurors were all death qualified. They swore that if they were convinced that the prosecutor had established the required aggravating factors during the months of testimony at this hearing, a lot of people really believed the prosecution team had done just that, that they would impose the death penalty. Let's examine their arguments, and then what the defense put forward. The prosecution team was really led by Jeff Marcus, assistant state prosecutor. The actual state attorney, Michael Satz, was deeply involved in the case, comes as no surprise, but Marcus was the on-the-ground lawyer who's in court carrying a lot of the weight. All told, both the prosecution and defense teams were huge. There were lawyers and lawyers and lawyers at both tables. Marcus focused on the following aggravating factors in the state's pursuit of the death penalty. The defendant was previously convicted of another capital felony or of a felony involving the use or threat of violence to the person. This was the assault on Sergeant Ray Beltran at the jail. Since he had pled guilty to that, that conviction technically counted for the purposes of this aggravating factor since it was another felony involving violence to the person. They also argued that the defendant knowingly created a great risk of death to many persons. They argued that this capital felony was especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel. And they argued that the capital felony was a homicide, or 17 homicides, committed in cold, calculated, and premeditated manner, without any pretense of moral or legal justification. Knowing what we know about the Parkland shooting, just the act itself. I can understand why the prosecution team probably felt pretty comfortable that they were going to be able to establish these aggravating factors. The procedure of this hearing was basically the same as a trial would have been. The prosecutor puts on their case initially. They put their evidence in, they call their witnesses, then the defense has an opportunity to put in their evidence in an effort to counter. And then the prosecution is afforded a rebuttal case. They can call additional witnesses or recall witnesses to rebut what the arguments made by the defense are. Then the defense can address the rebuttal and on and on and on until everybody rests. The evidence that the prosecution put in during their original presentation can be sorted into two basic groups. It was testimony from family and friends of the victims describing their pain, their loss, their suffering, the ways that every single day of their lives has been different, and how they will never fully recover. This testimony was absolutely heartbreaking to watch and listen to. So many people broke down on the stand. Commentators had trouble keeping their eyes dry. Cruz sat through it all, expressionless, emotionless, often with his head down. Witness after witness recounted the events of the afternoon on the worst day of their lives. Some are forced to live with the last words that they said to their child being an argument that morning before they ran out the door to get the bus. One sent her child to school despite claims that the kid felt sick and wanted to stay home. The guilt that these parents felt was visceral. So many testified about how their job as a parent was to protect their child, and they felt that they had failed to do so. Many had very choice words to describe Nicholas Cruz. Much of this testimony can be found on YouTube if you search for it. I don't recommend watching it. You cannot unhear these stories, and some of them will haunt you. Take my word for it. These parents were angry, ashamed, enraged, despairing, despondent, broken, and tortured. The other evidence that the prosecutors put forward was to show premeditation. The state argued that Cruz was a calculating killer who had planned this act for months. They showed the jury videos Cruz had recorded of himself, talking about shooting up the school, thinking about how to maximize casualties, wanting to be remembered for it. He openly talked about, in his videos for months leading up to February 2018, his plans, and he idolized past school shooters. His web search browser history was put on a big screen and shown to the jury. Cruz was constantly conducting internet searches for past school shooters, songs about school shootings, Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, the specific weapon that he used. In the notes on his cell phone on December 30th, 2017, less than 2 months before the MSD massacre, he wrote, "Control your breathing and trigger pull. You're the one who sights in the rifle for yourself. Keep that adjustment every time. You have to shoot to yourself only once. My trigger squeeze is one's ability to do the same thing every time." There is no question that Cruz was building up to his final action. He idolized past mass shooters, especially school shooters, and felt angry at the world. His entire life began to revolve around becoming a mass killer. And other than an obscene amount of pornography, nearly all of his internet activities revolved around his desire to kill people. The jury was flooded with his messages, browser history, playlists of songs about school shootings, notes, photos, even doodles Cruz had made when he was in school depicting violence were introduced. It all showed that Cruz didn't wake up one morning and snap. He had been planning this for months. He had no moral or legal justification. He didn't even have an individual target. This wasn't an inappropriate way to get back at a bully. He wanted the notoriety that he expected to get from causing mayhem and carnage. He wanted to be remembered. He wanted to be feared. He wanted to live in infamy. Watching the evidence go in, it was compelling. There was emotionally gut-wrenching testimony, combined with a seemingly endless flow of evidence showing how badly Cruz wanted to become a school shooter. And by the time the state rested, every aspect of Cruz's life relating to the MSD shooting had been organized, cataloged, zoomed in, and put on a big screen for the jury. Then it was the defense team's turn to put forth a case to show why Nicholas Cruz should be spared the death penalty. So what do you say? What do you argue? The chief public defender of the homicide division of the Broward County Public Defender's Office was Melissa McNeil. She had a huge team of attorneys as well. She did what I think most savvy defense attorneys would agree is the only viable argument to make. Cruz was seriously and dangerously mentally ill, and because of that, should not be put to death. I give McNeil's team a lot of credit for their strategy during this hearing itself. And most lawyers, I think, would have argued mental illness. They had an expert who testified about his antisocial personality disorder and a wide array of other issues. The defense brought up that his mother drank excessively while pregnant, and that as a result, Cruz had fetal alcohol syndrome, which caused lasting brain damage. Essentially, he never really had a chance to be anything other than what he was. And while McNeil did argue this, she went a step further, and this is why I was a bit impressed. She took a lot of the prosecutor's evidence head on. Rather than ignoring it or downplaying it, she co-opted it. She argued that Cruz's history of doodling horrific acts of violence were demonstrative of his damaged brain, that his videos worshiping and idolizing the Aurora mass shooter were symptoms of his mental illness. As a defense attorney, when you're looking at the evidence which a prosecutor introduces, there are a few ways you can handle it. If you ignore it, what you're doing is trying to send a message to the jury that this evidence isn't worth the time to address, and so the jury should just disregard it. There are some times when that's appropriate, and it's the tactic most often taken when there is simply no way around what the evidence is or what it shows. Another strategy is to combat it. Introduce contradictory evidence to try and make the claim that the prosecutor's evidence is wrong. And in closing arguments, you assert that the facts are the way that you have presented them as opposed to the way the prosecutor presented it. The third avenue one can take up is arguably the most difficult. It's appropriate the prosecutor's evidence and showing that it actually favors your argument. It's accepting the evidence is what the prosecutor says it is, but that the interpretation of that evidence should prove what the defense is arguing. This has a lot of potential to backfire, and backfire tremendously. Acknowledging that certain pieces of evidence are legitimate can cause your case harm if the jury doesn't buy into how you framed your interpretation of it. But on the other hand, it can be a very powerful tool. It not only weakens the prosecutor's case, but it weakens the prosecutor. The jury is left with the impression that the prosecutor is either incompetent, how could they have possibly come up with this erroneous interpretation, or malicious. The prosecutor is trying to sell the jury a lie about what certain things mean. In that regard, it becomes extremely beneficial to the defense if executed correctly. McNeil's team did an impressive job of trying to change the narrative. And in this particular case, that was not an easy task. When the prosecution rested, I think it's a safe assumption that everyone in the courtroom, including the jurors, held a significant amount of disdain for Nicholas Cruz. The defense argument boiled down to this: you don't need to like Nicholas Cruz. It's okay that you don't like Nicholas Cruz, but you need to understand and appreciate that his brain is broken, that his entire life has been a series of self-destructive decisions where obvious pleas for help and attention were ignored. Yes, he did a horrific thing, but he should not be killed for it. Now again, I don't fully understand the decision to argue this at the penalty hearing as opposed to during a trial, seeking to have him committed to a mental institution as opposed to prison. Even if the jury came back and convicted him of all the charges, the defense could still argue that his mental illness was mitigation for the death penalty purposes at the subsequent hearing. And maybe someday someone on the defense team will publicly discuss the strategy, but to date, it's still a mystery to me. One of the major topics that both the prosecution and the defense spent a significant amount of time talking about, and in which I thought was especially poignant in this trial, was executive function. And as I watched the hearing unfold, it was very interesting to me to see how both sides tried to describe executive function and how it applied to Cruz. The prosecution looked at it in a particularly granular level. Their expert discussed executive function with respect to Cruz's ability to plan for situations and adapt. They discussed the various levels of preparation needed to carry out the MSD attack, showing that his executive function worked fine, and thus his mental illness did not preclude him from premeditation. Getting an Uber to get to the school, carrying extra ammo, knowing exactly where he was going, sweeping the rooms, going through the classrooms. Everything that he did was designed with a purpose. In essence, his methodology indicated complex problem-solving ability, which would not be present in someone with such grave mental deficiencies. But when the defense expert discussed executive function, they chose to look at it from a global level. His entire thought process, they argued, demonstrated serious flaws due to his mental illness. Besides the mentally disturbed nature of the act itself, his obsession with mass shootings and school shooters was further evidence of his insanity. Cruz had developmental problems as a child. To say that he was a below-average student would be generous. He'd shown poor judgment in so many areas that the defense argued his executive functioning was systemically impaired. What I really found interesting about these approaches was that they really are a microcosm of the general approaches to a case taken by a prosecutor and a defense attorney. And this is not a set-in-stone rule, but generally speaking, prosecutors approach criminal cases by focusing on the incident itself. A law was broken, the defendant did the act, punishment ensues. The defendant is conceptualized on a granular level by the one specific instance of conduct. Defense attorneys, on the other hand, look at the defendant holistically. One action does not define who the defendant is, even if there's no way of getting around the need to punish for that specific behavior. And this makes sense because defense attorneys spend a lot of time with their clients, and prosecutors don't. In summation, Nicholas Cruz is going to be spending the rest of his life in prison. I don't think anyone is going to be losing sleep over that particular fact. The jury opted not to impose the death penalty, and Judge Scherer is obliged under Florida law to abide by that. I've never really been convinced by the death penalty as a deterrent argument. Looking at the data, states which have the death penalty don't really seem to be doing any better than states that don't in terms of potentially capital crime commission. Having spent a lot of time with the type of criminals who commit capital crimes, not one of them has ever struck me as someone who, mid-murder, would take a step back and think about whether killing someone might expose him to an execution. That level of decision-making simply just doesn't exist. In addition to the fact that I don't actually think it deters anything, it's pretty clear there is no ability to fix a mistake. While I don't think we routinely execute innocent people in this country, one time is way too many. We've exonerated far too many executed prisoners with DNA years after their death. It's awful enough when people spend 20, 30 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. Killing an innocent person because mistakes were made is plainly unacceptable to me. Even in situations like the Parkland shooting, where we know Nicholas Cruz is the murderer, where he's confessed to it, where he doesn't appear at all remorseful about it, where we're inundated with evidence that he wanted to be a famous mass murderer, where there's virtually no conceivable argument that he isn't guilty, I don't support it. Our government should not be in the business of killing its own citizens, regardless of whether or not they're convicted murderers. I respect that some people want to exact an eye for an eye. I recognize that it would not be easy to sit in a room with the parents of a murdered Parkland student and tell them that I don't think Nicholas Cruz should be put to death. But that is exactly what I would do. And it's not because I feel sorry for Nicholas Cruz. I personally think he's the worst kind of monster. But debates over policies like the death penalty aren't won or lost with the obvious cases. It's the gray areas, the on-the-line decisions, which determine where we fall. And the fact that we have put people to death after they were convicted at a trial, and then we later learned that someone lied on the stand, or some evidence was fabricated, or an identification didn't really stand up, whatever it was, we can't go back and right that wrong. And even if we somehow devise some technology to 100% guarantee that we never executed an innocent person again, I still wouldn't support state executions. I simply don't believe that a government should be in the business of death for their own citizens. I'm thankful that in states like Florida, which do have the death penalty and which do utilize it, there are at least some checks put in place to limit unilateral discretion on its imposition. I think it's better to have the recommendation come from a jury to the judge, and then let the judge have discretion. So that's the show on Nicholas Cruz and the death penalty hearing in Florida. Thank you, as always, to my brother Dan Townsend for editing today's program. Thank you, listeners, for your support of In Summation. I really do appreciate the thoughtful messages that I get and the discussions that they often generate. Thank you, Eric Williams, for suggesting the topic for this episode. It seems the show also has a growing law student following, which I think is amazing, and I really hope you aspiring young lawyers get something useful from it. On that note, if you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or a case, if you want to ask a question about criminal law, or you just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can follow the show's website, insummation.com, check out the show's Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And if you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out the entire catalog. Also, a special thank you to everyone who has been reaching out about guest episodes. I will certainly continue to mix guests in as often as I can, as the conversations really seem to be enjoyable for listeners. So that's really great. Makes me very happy that people are reaching out, saying they are enjoying both the mix of guests and monologues. As always, thanks very much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.